You're listening to Lanyap, a weekly digest of news, personal finance, brotherly banter, and whatever else is on our minds from Stokes Family Office.
All right, Doug and Greg Stokes, Lanyap Podcast. It is November the 1st, All Saints Day, which is in New Orleans is an important day simply because it's the day that the New Orleans Saints were founded. It's probably, 50 years ago now, or more. But anyway, it's also the day after Halloween. Greg and I went out with our kids yesterday evening. I think my kids had a bit of a costume fail. Sarah wanted to dress them up as characters from Matilda and didn't really go over well. Nobody really understood what they were dressed up as. Greg, how was your Halloween?
It was great. Special thanks to our friends in the Uptown neighborhood that let us crash their houses and everything. Uptown New Orleans is a wonderful place for Halloween. People go all out. And State Street, which is a block away from our house, was blocked off from traffic. And so it was really nice. And an enjoyable experience for our family.
Well, good. Well, there's a lot going on in the world and in markets. I think the most interesting story from this week, there's a book on Ray Dalio in Bridgewater coming out. I think it's next week. And there was an article in the New York Times this morning detailing the secrecy of Bridgewater and Dalio. And I think I think the general rule of thumb here is that if any investment manager espouses their returns on secrecy, you run for the hills. And so it's a pretty scathing review of Bridgewater. Doesn't full out call them a Ponzi, but it goes into a lot of questions as to how they've achieved their returns and how really Dalio came to fame. And he became most famous by virtue of his hedge fund being up in 2008, 2009, and gathered a lot of assets in the wake of that. And so I think the moral of this story, we have no insider knowledge here, so it could be everything's legit for Bridgewater. But I think the moral of this story is when there's when things are, number one, too good to be true, and number two, the source of returns are framed in secrecy or veiled in secrecy, it's probably something you don't want to take a look at.
Yeah, I've always said in finance, if you couldn't explain it to a seven-year-old, it's probably something you would want to avoid. Like, for example, you can explain cash and stocks and bonds or whatever to a seven-year-old, but you certainly can't explain the black box or approach of an all-weather strategy that was being espoused by Ray Dalio. Speaking of the sort of smartest guys in the room, did you see that article on the hedge fund? I think it was Two Sigma or Six Sigma or something like that, where one of their traders,
Two Sigma,
one of their traders went and secretly adjusted the algorithm of the fund. And it was like these are like high frequency traders or whatever that use a computer algorithm to take advantage of volatility and make money based upon movements in the market short term. Somebody went in there, one of their associates went in there and changed the formula, and actually on a net basis made the firm like $400 million or something like that. I noticed they didn't fire him, yeah. But they put him on.
Yeah, it's funny. The summary of this is that the Two Sigma, at least they were accused of, I think they settled the case, but accused of front running their own customers. And so the customers were getting worse returns than the partners fund, which is always a good thing when you're trying to squeeze your investors who have trusted you with their assets. But I think that world is very opaque. And of course, there are a lot of fund managers and hedge funds in general that are doing things by the book and have great track records as a result. But in terms of complexity for your 99.9% of investors, doesn't really make sense to go down the complex rabbit hole, especially without a major due diligence process on who the sponsor is, because in this case, Dalio and Bridgewater were not opening up their book as to their source of returns. You know, it may all be legitimate again, but if you're, how do you even underwrite or diligence an investment firm when they don't tell you how they invest? They just show you their returns. It's just one of those things where greed takes over.
Right. It's, well, the same thing happened with Bernie Madoff, in that there's people that, and
again, we're not saying that Dalio is Madoff,
but right? Exactly.
He might be
right. Exactly. But Bernie Madoff, which he actually ran a parallel legitimate business as a trader, but his fund basically was reporting consistent 12% returns or whatever on an annual basis, and they were just all fabricated, and there was no sort of rhyme or reason to it. But people tend to their desire to do due diligence goes away when there's consistent returns and people are making money, et cetera. And so the same thing maybe.
And there's a gatekeeper that, you know, if you ask too many questions, you're going to get kicked out. You're not going to be able to invest with
exactly.
us.
Exactly. So you're not going to be a part of, you're not going to be invited to the party. Exactly.
Right.
So, and nobody wants to just buy and hold quality equities or bonds or whatever, and get some pretty similar returns and deal with the volatility, of course. The same thing goes with annuities. I mean, if you buy a fixed annuity, for example, like a 10-year fixed annuity, they'll promise you whatever rate of return, but like a 5% rate of return. If you just bought a bond, you would have the annuity. The difference between an annuity and a bond is the annuity just reports the principal value at 100 cents every single year, regardless of what happens in the market. But if you buy a bond, you have to deal with the actual price. You can price the bond on an annual basis, so you have to deal with volatility. The same thing goes with these sort of black box strategies, in that there is a lot of opaqueness in terms of the volatility because they're not reporting it in a marketed manner. Whereas you get a marketed volatility in stocks and bonds that's somewhat uncomfortable. But anyway, in finance, like I said, simple is usually better. Not usually better, 99.9% of the time better. And if you can't explain it to a 7-year old, a lot of times it is it's a red flag, essentially.
Yeah. Speaking of simple, we've been talking the last couple of weeks about the relationship and relative valuation of stocks and bonds in today's market. And what I had discussed previously was it's really difficult in today's market to see value in stocks when bonds are trading at 5% plus interest rates long term. And so if you have let's say you have a 20, the market is less than this, but let's say you have a 20 PE stock market and a 5% yielding treasury bond, those are effectively the same yield. 20 PE is just 1 over 20 earnings yield, or 5% earnings yield. The 10-year treasury at 5% is a 5% yield. And so historically and logically, if you're taking more risk, you should be getting more return. I mean, that's the essentially the equity risk premium in a nutshell. And so why would you pay 20 times earnings or 18 times earnings for a stock market when the bond market is giving you that same essential return, risk-free from the perspective of it's backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government? Lawrence Hamtill, who's really a great writer, actually hasn't written in a while, but wrote a great piece on this, and the piece is titled "How Inflation Altered the Stock Bond Relationship." When inflation is low and stable, earnings yield less bond yield is a useful tool, but when inflation is high and unpredictable, bonds become, in a way, a riskier instrument over the long term. And what he states is, you would think that investors would demand a risk premium for owning stocks relative to government bonds given this, but the reality is that over the last several decades, the risk premium has been essentially zero. And he has a chart that shows this. We'll put in the show notes and on LinkedIn. In fact, during the tremendous equity bull market of the 80s and 90s, stocks would have been considered overvalued relative to bonds pretty much the entire period, which is really interesting. We could have made this argument in 1980, and we would have been wrong. You would have been better to own stocks in the 80s and 90s than own bonds. And then he cites an article in the Financial Analyst Journal in 1982 that states, in a world of uncertain inflation, which we're dealing with right now, all classes of fixed income securities are exposed to an element of risk that is not shared to the same degree by shareholders. With uncertain inflation, the bond investor has to worry about the risk of substantial loss of capital if the rate inflation turns out to be greater than anticipated. The shareholder, however, receives some measure of protection against inflation because of the ability of the firm in which he is a shareholder or her, she is a shareholder, to raise its prices. So this is really interesting in the dynamic that we've heard a lot about today, that stocks are overvalued relative to bonds, which I generally agree with, but here's a way to debunk that. In a world of high and unstable inflation, which we're experiencing now for the first time in decades, the bond investor has a major risk of elevated inflation and inflation running away from the bondholder, while the stockholder, the company that they're invested in, just keep raising prices to keep up with inflation. And so this just leads to the fact that a balanced portfolio always is the right recipe, and constant rebalancing is always the right recipe for investors, in that the bonds rates could go way down, inflation come down, the bond investor wins. And then stocks, if inflation keeps up, you'd rather own stocks than own bonds in this environment.
The other thing to think about too is, if you just look at the rolling returns, rolling 20-year returns from like the last 100 years till present, something like only one or two of the times over those rolling 20-year periods have bonds outperformed stocks. So if I agree, bonds are very attractive right now on a relative basis to equities, and on a relative basis to where bond yields were not too long ago. I mean, in March of 2020, the 10-year treasury was 0.5%, and now it's 5%. So it's exploded to the chagrin of anybody who was obviously owning bonds at that point in time. The 30-year treasury was like 1% or something like that, and now it's 5%. So just a massive move in interest rates. And then on a relative basis, like you said, that the earnings yield on equity markets is like 5%. Bonds are paying about 5%. So, all else being equal, it just seems like it's a relatively good deal to equities and relatively good deal to where yields were not too long ago. But if you close your eyes to that and just look at history, all else being equal, something like over, in this, I don't know how many rolling 20-year periods have existed over this period of time, but you're talking about in the low single digits as far as the percentage likelihood that bonds are going to outperform stocks over a 20-year period. So,
on both,
right? Or if you're trying to go for the maximum amount of return and you can deal with the volatility inherent in stocks, even though bonds look very attractive right now, maybe you make the decision to just close your eyes and buy stocks.
Yeah, and if you're a saver and somebody that has a long time horizon, you're young or whatever, or young at heart, and are planning to work for an extended period of time, volatility in stocks works to your favor. If volatility picks up and stocks go down, you're buying more at lower prices. Bonds, you don't really get that same, although the last couple of years would be different, but historically you don't get that same level of volatility. And so you're buying in whatever the going rate is at that time, not, you know, picking up something on the cheap, which you get to do pretty regularly in the stock market. And by regularly, this is Charlie Bilello posted this in terms of intra-year declines in the S&P 500. So those opportunities that open up to stock investors, how often do they happen? We've talked about, right now we're in a 10% drawdown from the market peak on July 31st. Of 2023. How often does that happen? 63% of years since 1928 experience a 10% plus drawdown intra-year. It happens every 1.6 years. 15% happens every 2.5 years. We had a 25% drawdown last year. How often does that happen? Every 5 years, a 25% drawdown happens. 30% every 9 years. And so What this really translates to is that the equity investor, in order to achieve equity-like returns, you need to accept equity-like volatility. But at the same time, if you're a saver in the market, you get these opportunities that open up to you where you get to buy at incredibly attractive prices every couple of years.
Yeah, totally. And it, as it relates to the long-term trajectory of you, the United States, I found this in the U.S. markets, I found this really interesting. This chart prepared by Bloomberg and Goldman Sachs and posted by Sam Rowe. The largest equity market capitalization in the world is the United States. Just to illustrate how dominant we are as a equity capitalization relative to the next competitor, the U.S. Market cap grew by 250% over the last 20 years and is almost five times larger than that of the next market, which is mainland China. So 20 years ago, the United States was still dominant, but just absolutely has clobbered the competition. And we're five times bigger than China, essentially. Japan is probably half the size of China. Hong Kong is the next one on the list. India, France, Saudi Arabia, the Ukraine. I guess this is their markets were significant on the global scale. But really, just totally dominant. It'll be interesting to see. And this has obviously been a something that's developed over the last 100 years. I was talking to our dad about this. He said, "Well, if you would have just bought the S&P 500 and shut your eyes to it over the last 100 years, how great would that have been?" And I told him, "Yeah, of course that'd have been great." But the makeup of the United States 100 years ago, in 1923, was completely different, and we were an emerging market essentially at that point in time. We were not the global power that we are today. So it'll be really interesting to see how this trajectory changes over time. It's been, if you would have asked me, this is 20 years ago, that would we have maintained the same level of dominance? I would have probably said no. I mean, it's just hard to be. It's kind of like the innovator's dilemma. In the landscape of large companies, like, it's hard for companies to consistently be in the top of all U.S. or all publicly traded companies, because there's always companies nipping at their heels, and bureaucracy becomes entrenched, and usually it's really tough to stay at that top level. If you would ask me 20 years ago, would the United States stay at that top level, I would have said probably not, because of that innovator's dilemma. But lo and behold, we have our equity market capitalization has grown by 250% from then to now. But it'll really be interesting to see how.
Yeah, and think about what's happened in the last 20 years. I mean, 20 years ago, we were in the midst of a tech bubble bursting. We invaded Iraq. We had the largest housing crisis in history, followed by what's coming, what seemingly is one of the another large real estate crisis that we're experiencing right now. We had a pandemic. We had a downgrade of government debt twice over this period, and still stocks are just chugging along higher. So really interesting insight in that we have so much negative news, and when you have a free society that has great natural resources that people want to move to and immigrate to, and you have a culture of innovation and growth, then that's what translates to great market returns.
You know what? I was thinking about this the other day, and in terms of like the if you look at the number of patents filed, for example, in the United States relative to any other country, or think about it like this: the inventions that changed the world, where there's a lot of the inventors themselves, like, for example, Alexander Graham Bell was Scottish, but he came to the United States and invented the telephone. But like a lot of so many inventions that impact the world occur in the United States. We just foster this sort of capitalism. And our economy is so open and allows these things to, allows inventors to the ability to take advantage of their inventions from an economic standpoint. But if you just look back at history and then the modern age, all of these, not all of these, but a huge percentage, a striking percentage really of inventions take place in the United States. And if you look at back at specifically over the last 20 years, the companies that are now the largest market cap in the world are all based in the United States, but like 20 years ago, the Apple iPhone didn't even exist. Now that's the biggest company, and now it's a part of our lives. I'm wearing my iWatch right now. My iPhone was just buzzing, and Microsoft Office is now everywhere in the commercial setting. It's just there's so much ingenuity that takes place here. We obviously have our faults, but the level of openness in our economy, capitalism, our rule of law, et cetera, has allowed us to become dominant, and over the last 20 years, continue that dominance and really accelerate it. And it will be absolutely interesting to see if we can maintain that. I mean, if judging by that, my last comment was, if you asked me 20 years ago, will we maintain this? I would probably say no, just because of that innovator's dilemma. But and there's obviously a lot of stuff going on in terms of the United States, and we have our issues or whatever, but we're still like what I would categorize as the nicest house on a bad block, meaning the global landscape.
Yeah, I would agree. I use that analogy when people ask me about the dollar and debasing the dollar by pumping all the liquidity that the Congress and the Federal Reserve did into the economy in 2020 and 2021, and really in 2022 as well. And then you just look at the dollar's strength against other currencies since COVID, and it's
right. Do you want to? Well, you want to hold the pound? I mean, the pound at one point. Yeah, right. I mean, everything's quoted in in dollars or whatever. So so the pound was down 30% against the dollar. We're basically the gold standard of currencies. And you can make the argument that okay, well, there's something better. This particular currency is better for this reason or another. But like, do you really want to buy the Chinese yuan or whatever? It's not. I don't see it as from a commercial setting that there's our adversaries. Like for example, Russia is proponing the utilization of the ruble and or the rupee in India or whatever. But I just don't see that become.
Yeah. Good luck.
Good luck.
So we can't conclude a podcast without at least talking about inflation for a second. So we'll have that as our last quick topic, and then we'll wrap it up. And I found this interesting from JP Morgan 2 days ago. They said this is a chart that posts the inflation adjusted excess liquidity since March of 2020. So we just talked about how the Fed and Congress pumped a bunch of liquidity into the system in 2020 through 2022. Here's JP Morgan, and they say excess household liquidity, cash equivalent assets has fallen from peak of $3.4 trillion to $1 trillion and should largely be exhausted by second quarter of 2024. Importantly, even as of second quarter of 2023, nearly all of the inflation-adjusted excess liquidity sits with the relatively affluent top 20%. And then this chart basically shows that the bottom 20 to 100% have exhausted all whatever stimulus and liquidity that was pumped into the system from March of 2020, which then leads to the core personal consumption or PCE index and inflation numbers that keep coming out. Core goods have fallen to over a year-over-year basis, basically zero growth. Core PCE is still sitting at 3.7%, but that's largely driven by housing, which is north of 7%. But what you'll see in this chart, this is from the Commerce Department, everything is rolling over. And so when you have less liquidity, less ability to spend, higher interest rates, slowing down economy, and then you look at where is inflation going from here, it's not coming from people having more money in their pockets, because other than the top 20%, that's essentially been exhausted.
Yeah, and if you look at the data as it relates to the average American, which is what we're talking about here, something like 60% couldn't afford an unexpected expense over $600 or something like that. And so it's no surprise that the excess liquidity that the average American had after all the COVID stimulus or whatever is gone. And gone away. And we talked about this as it relates to there's a Wall Street Journal article written about people trading down to cheaper beer and cigarettes, etc. So the lower income individuals are basically substituting from Budweiser or whatever to Busch Light and cheap cigarettes, etc. So that those sort of trends have already started happening and have been going on a while, and so it's no surprise. But in any event, we hope you guys enjoyed this discussion, and if you enjoyed it, please share it with your friends and family, and give us 5 stars, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lanyap. This podcast is brought to you by Stokes Family Office. If you liked this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. You can subscribe to future episodes in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information about Stokes Family Office and Lanyap, visit us at stokesfamilyoffice.com. The information in this podcast is educational and general in nature and does not take into consideration the listener's personal circumstances. Therefore, it is not intended to be a substitute for specific, individualized financial, legal, or tax advice. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a final decision.